The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see
them. We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Tom Slater is the guest this week, and we discuss his book out from Macmillan entitled Unsafe Space, The Crisis of Free Speech on Campus. It's Thursday, May 12th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Next week, Zero Books will be hosting a panel at the Left Forum in New York City. Look for us on the schedule, and please join us as we discuss how to overcome capitalism. A while back, Zero Squared featured a podcast with C. Derek Varn entitled Trolls and Tumblrites, and after that podcast, I felt that it might be possible to put the question of identity politics behind us. I felt like I'd reached an understanding about what was going on and why these battles continued. But while I'd reached an understanding, it was only conceptual. In material reality, the war continues, the cultural war rages on, no platforming continues, and the dude bros and harpies are gathering at the gates. Tom Slater's book is written in response to all of that. In this episode, you'll hear from some Yalies who are afraid of Halloween, Joan Baez, instructions on how to freeze a peach, and clips from John Adams' The Chairman Dances and Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. Right now you're listening to the Vitamin String Quartet cover of Happy by Pharrell Williams, but in just a moment you'll hear from Tom Slater as we discuss unsafe spaces. Tom Slater is deputy editor at Spiked UK, and he coordinates Spike's free speech campaigns, Down With Campus Censorship. Tom has written on politics, pop culture, and free speech for The Spectator, The Telegraph, The Times, and The Independent, amongst other places. He is also the editor of a new collection from Palgrave Macmillan entitled Unsafe Space, The Crisis of Free Speech on Campus. Tom Slater, welcome to the Zero Squared podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm interested to know how this book came together. Just did you put this together because of your work with Down With Campus Censorship?
The problem with censorship on university campuses is something that Spiked in particular has been interested in and writing about and campaigning about since really it started in 2000. But when I came on board, which was around 2013, we noticed that all of the problems that we'd always railed against in terms of no platforming speakers, as they call it here in the UK, in terms of trying to censor certain ideas and certain texts, had just gone haywire. I mean, this is where you saw in the UK at least 30 campuses ban Blurred Lines, a pop song, almost as many ban a newspaper, The Sun, and just the bar for censorship getting lower and lower. So in reaction to that, we thought it was time for us to really kind of up our game. And so we launched Down With Campus Censorship, which was a campus campaign working with students across the country to hold debates on this. And then we also launched our Free Speech University Rankings, which is our a kind of UK-wide league table of campus censorship. And so through writing on this, through chronicling it, through interrogating it, and through picking up loads of great writers and thinkers along the way, we felt that it was time for a substantial intervention that really looked at this moment in particular, this new obsession with safety, this lower and lower bar of censorship, but also tried to historicize it a little bit, look at the roots of it, and look at the different aspects of the discussion. So that's really how Unsafe Space came about.
I attended university back in the 90s, which shockingly to me, but not to anyone else, is a long time ago now. But back then, college students were living in the shadow of their parents' generation. And college was supposed to be a hotbed of radicalism and left politics. Has that sentiment gone away?
I think there's certainly a desire to dress up what they're doing as some form of radicalism, but that's definitely not the case. I mean, I graduated in 2012, so not that long ago, and there was still a bit of a sort of hanger-on of kind of old-fashioned left-wing, shall we say, student politics. There were still people who were interested in these broader issues. It was a little bit throwback, a little bit nostalgic, but nevertheless, I think the sentiment was there. But what seemed to happen was, as much of this censorship kind of crept in, it kind of became very much not only censorious and illiberal, which in some sense is always anti-political, right? If you don't believe people are capable of reckoning with ideas, then them changing the world will also therefore be off the table. But also it just became so petty and so boring and so kind of ridiculous. I mean, in the past, particularly the student left in the UK, they were obsessed with kind of censoring fascists, Islamists, but it was still a kind of part of political contestation. It was a liberal and wrong-headed, in my view. But at the same time, there was a sense about there being something greater at stake. When you're going around censoring pop songs, sombreros, and just trying to micromanage the kind of minutiae of student life, then those kind of ideas are really off the table. So I think while they dress it up as incredibly radical to try and snuff out anything that least bit offensive, I think what it really speaks to is the kind of dearth of any political imagination. You know, they're obsessed with micromanaging the little world that they have on campus rather than trying to reckon with, understand, and ultimately change the world beyond them. So I think really this is it's become the kind of the last gasp of anything resembling student radicalism, this surge in safe space censorship.
You know, the other day I was talking to a university professor who had been teaching for 30 years, and he was railing against the fact that the university system now, especially in the United States, has become a diploma mill. It's all about career advancement and not about learning. Do you think that goes hand in hand with this shift in the way students approach politics on campus and in the way they think about campus life?
I think there's definitely an element to that. And I think you're right to say that it goes hand in hand, because I think there's some people who want to blame the transformation of university into a kind of almost like a sort of consumerist thing. As far as you pay your money, you get your degree through it, and then you can trade that up for a better job at the end of it. That's certainly come into place. But I think it's really a product of the fact that universities have really drifted so far away from their core values, the sorts of ideas that they were founded upon, these high-minded Enlightenment principles of pursuing truth and disseminating those ideas throughout the population, to the point where all of these other concerns have kind of come into place. So I think it's definitely true. I mean, there's this idea today popular amongst kind of university administrators that the student is a consumer ultimately, and you have to kind of keep them happy. And if censoring ideas that they find a little bit bristling keeps them happy, then so be it. And that's why you've had so much kind of institutional collaboration with these kind of student campus crazies, because they're quite willing to cave in for the sake of maintaining those kind of student satisfaction levels. So I think it definitely plays a role, but it's really, I think, the marriage between those kind of hollowed out institutions along with this new quite illiberal sentiment which has come together to create the state of play that we see at the moment.
Yeah. Now, your introduction to your book starts off by pointing to the free speech movement and juxtaposing that moment with today's student activism. Do you think that Mario Savio would look at, he was a leader of the free speech movement, just for people who don't know, he would look at what's happening on today's campus as sort of the ultimate result of this model of the university as factory that he was railing against? Or do you think that the politics of the free speech movement, this left politics, has actually led to the call for safe spaces? In other words, is this a problem in the university, or is this a problem with left thinking?
The point that you're gesturing to, which is quite commonly made these days, which is that the free speech movement, while it was seen as this kind of great strike for freedom, was actually something else. It was the beginning, really, of this US kind of new left, which, as it developed, did pick up a lot of kind of authoritarian tendencies. That's certainly true. I mean, this is what most people would call the kind of tenured radical phenomenon, right? You have these kind of new left firebrands who came of age in the 60s, and then as they kind of were tenured, they began to preside over this increasingly politically homogenous, often speech policing campuses, you know, the sort of people who influenced the start of the speech code craze, etc. But I think ultimately it's a little bit simplistic to draw that straight a line, insofar as I think the degradation of free speech on campus is, as I was saying, a kind of culmination of myriad factors. I've mentioned two so far, but there's so many more. And I think it runs the risk a little bit of rewriting what did happen at Berkeley, because this was a coalition of students dedicated to, at least, you know, they made a point of saying this was absolute freedom of speech. They were, of course, mostly kind of lefties, civil rights activists, but contained within that coalition, there were even groups like Students for Goldwater, right? These are the people who could be very much their political enemies at the time, Goldwater having opposed the Civil Rights Act. So, and a couple of years ago, in 2014, on the anniversary, the 50th anniversary, I interviewed a couple of surviving FSM leaders, and even someone like Bettina Apthecker, you know, who's a huge presence in the movement, would go on to kind of define things like intersectionality, which has obviously been a huge influence on the kind of censorious feminism that we see today. But even she made a point of saying, look, you can't censor anything, including hate speech. Whether or not she fully lived up to that throughout her academic or political career is another discussion. But I think it goes to show that the FSMers definitely weren't perfect, but it was a point at which students kind of drew a bit of a line in the sand. They kind of stuck up for free speech, for, and importantly, for treating themselves as individuals and adults and not children. You know, this went hand in hand with the end of In Loco Parentis. So I think that's very important. And even if it was something which was a little bit more short-termist, it was just about being able to air their particular political views, or even if it was just something a bit more visceral, stop patronising us, I think it was a line in the sand. It was a kind of striking out for freedom and a belief that students should play a role in changing the world, that they were political agents in that sense. And I see none of that spirit here today, not least because it's censorious, but because they have a very, there's a contained within the modern campus censorship, a very, very low view of the individual. So I think compared to today, the free speech movement really is a blow for freedom that we should look to and celebrate.
We should maybe slow down a bit and provide a little evidence about what we're talking about. The big moment that brought home that something had changed on college campuses, I think it was at Yale, there was this Halloween costume email that went out. And because of cell phone technology and how everything is caught and captured on video now, there was a confrontation on Yale's campus, which was captured, which I could watch, between a group of Black Lives Matter activist students, I'm going to say, maybe that's not a fair characterization, and then the husband of the woman who had written this very scandalous email, and which I read, and which wasn't scandalous at all. But is that kind of thing really common, where you have someone outright declaring, look, the campus isn't about intellectual life, it's about creating a safe space, about creating a family or a home for students to feel safe in? Is that really a very widely held position, or is this just sort of a fringe problem that happened to get viral on YouTube?
It's very similar to the kind of campus activist, shall we say, that we have in the UK. This argument that the university is basically a home, you know, and they say you wouldn't invite a racist into your home, therefore they don't want to reckon with these kinds of thinkers. And this refashioning as the university experience is one in which everyone should feel comfortable all the time, they shouldn't feel challenged, and that this bizarre kind of paradoxical idea that it's actually by not having challenging views on the table that you actually are able to come to some sort of greater understanding. It doesn't really make any sense. But I think it is important to stress the fact that this is, thankfully, a minority of students at this point. But they benefit off of two things. First of all, insofar as that this is what student politics means today. There isn't really any other game in town in terms of particularly kind of progressive student politics. And so they've been able to kind of have a level of attention and been able to kind of dominate in a way that wouldn't otherwise be possible. And I think it speaks to the fact that also we've had for a very long time institutions that have, despite the fact many of them are now, you're seeing loads of university professors, of heads of universities coming out now and criticizing these kind of coddled crybabies. For a very long time, they've gone along with these kinds of ideas. And I think that's also emboldened these kind of student politicos who do just want a censor speech and have that such a low view of themselves and their fellow students. That said, I think it's important to note that whilst this isn't all students, thankfully, most people studying are just normal. I think most of them are kind of put off by student politics because this is what it's become. They see nothing of themselves in it. They see nothing important in it. And therefore, they just kind of leave the blue-haired nutters to it. But at the same time, I think... these ideas are increasingly mainstreamed, and you see this where, by nature of how ridiculous things have gotten on campus, you know, censoring Halloween costumes, I mean, give me a break. It's still the case that on a visceral level, I think a lot of students are reacting against this. But I think the underlying trends are still very much there. And this is one thing you see very much in the UK, where you have students, for instance, campaigning against campus censorship, but still by the idea that women are treated terribly by men on campus and elsewhere, or people who are campaigning against campus censorship, but still by the idea that mental health problems are rife amongst students, amongst young people, and that we need more and more services, more and more intervention to look after them. So I think it's the case that, yes, campus censorship, especially its kind of mad safe space extreme, is luckily a fringe pursuit that is kind of emboldened by a lot of institutional cowardice. The underlying kind of trends which see students, young people, and everyone in general as vulnerable, as fragile, I think are actually quite mainstream, unfortunately. And that's what these safe space people are kind of the sharpest expressions of, I think.
You're talking a lot about people's attitudes or maybe institutional attitudes in the university. But I guess I have this knee-jerk kind of leftist structuralist approach to things where I want to say, okay, so why is this happening? What is this serving in the larger economy or the larger culture? The thing about college, my college experience is all about trying to figure out who you're going to be. And that goes along with figuring out what your career is going to be probably, but also what you stand for, what you want to do in the world. Maybe if you're standing in the shadow of your parents and you're a Gen Xer, you know, how you want to change the world. So is all of this a symptom of the fact that the political realm is actually unstable and we need to make sure that students and radicals are diverted off into this identity politics where they just look like nutters? Or is this a byproduct, again, of the economic realities of the university where it's all about career? Or what do you think the underlying structure is that's producing this? Or is it just a fad of thought?
Well, I think it's important not to see it as a fad, because otherwise I think it will never go away if we don't recognize it for what it is, which is, you know, it's a culmination, I think, of various factors. And I think it's reductionist to see this purely as an intellectual phenomenon. You know, it's a product of kind of authoritarian ideas that become very popular over the last 60 years. And it's reductionist to see this as a kind of immediate social phenomenon where, you know, certain trends, whether it be in helicopter parenting or how people conceive of themselves. I think it's the crashing together of a lot of these different things. But I think the important thing to recognize is that putting it in a kind of immediate context, I would point to three kind of very immediate factors, which one of which is this rise of this almost deification of self-esteem. And this is something you see very much across the US and the UK in terms of suggesting, whether it's through school anti-bullying policies or the kind of more broadly the kind of therapeutic movement which cropped up over the last 10 years, in which anything which chipped your self-esteem, anything which challenged you, meant you was kind of a mortal wound and that you should run to the nearest administrator, kindly official to kind of look after you. I think that's one factor. I think the other factor is the popularization of multiculturalism. This is particularly sharp in the UK in that it's a kind of matter of state policy and has been for a very long time, which is of course not multiculturalism as a fantastic lived experience, but as a policy which suggests that to make us all just about get along, we should be separated into these little boxes. We should be entitled to our ideas, but also entitled to not having them challenged. And I think, and painting any challenge to someone's ideas if they're of a particular background as a kind of act of sort of interpersonal imperialism, I think that's played a big role. And I think particularly in the UK, but also in the US as well, was this kind of broader conformist culture. I mean, and this desperate desire to censor those most extreme ideas. And again, particularly in the UK, you have this weird, we live in a country in which hate speech is criminalised. And I think that plays a big role. But even socially in the US, and this was the crux of the speech code movement, right, in the 90s, this desire, whilst you had the First Amendment, to nevertheless, on some measure, clamp down on the most extreme speech. And I think a combination of all these trends has just fed this idea that these students, that censorship is not only a bit of a moral good, but these students are also too vulnerable to deal with freedom of speech. So I think it's difficult to break it down into one or two different factors. I think it's a culmination of all these different things which have undermined autonomy, which have painted debate as dangerous. But those are three I'd certainly isolate as something quite current, last 10, 20 years, which have really brought about what we're looking at today.
So let's talk about your book directly. It's a collection of essays. Are all of the people who are involved in the book involved also with Spiked or with campaign to end campus censorship, or are these people coming from other publications and getting reprinted, or how did you select the essays?
So certainly a lot of the contributors are Spike contributors. Obviously, I'm in there. Our editor, Brendan O'Neill, who you spoke to a little while ago, is in there. Frank Ferrady is in there. Joanna Williams, our education editor, has also got a great book out called Academic Freedom in an Age of Conformity. So these are some of the Spike regulars who many people who read the magazine will recognize. Beyond that, we also have people like Greg Lukianoff, who's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. Definite kind of ally on these issues, but obviously his own political being in his own right. People like Peter Wood from the National Association of Scholars as well, and who wrote a great chapter about environmentalism and how that plays out on campus, and John O'Brien from Catholics for Choice, which is a great US pro-choice group. So yes, the kind of core of it is Spiked writers, Spiked thinkers, contributors, but we've also got some external contributors in there as well.
Well, listen, I guess because so much of it is from Spiked, I want to talk a little bit about Spiked and about Brendan O'Neill. Spiked was and is part of the left. It considers itself to be even on the Marxist side of the left spectrum. How do you view your book and what are your politics?
It's difficult to get into these discussions because, as you say, there's so many people who want to claim what is left and what isn't left and all the rest of it. But I think, I mean, for me, free speech, for instance, is a defining left-wing value. In the goal of expanding freedom and freedom of thought and freedom of speech as a prerequisite to progressive societal change is to me something I very much glean to. I mean, what I describe myself as, this is something that happens at Spiked at all. I'm comfortable with humanist. Again, getting into a kind of discussion about Marxism can often lead you down odd roads these days, insofar as people seem to think of it as something completely opposite to what it used to be about, insofar as limiting freedom, insofar as limiting growth and all the rest of it. So I don't like to get into these distinctions too much. It's just a fertile breeding ground for people to just have pot shots. But let's put it this way. I consider myself left of the left. I consider Spiked left of the left. And I think free speech is a defining left-wing value. Part of the problem we're up against today is that increasingly a lot of people on the left don't agree with that. And hopefully this book can play some role in showing that it is a progressive value and one that we should recover.
Here's what I think about Brendan O'Neill. He's brilliant. He was a really good guest, someone to talk to, and he could fill up the time in an entertaining way. And I've done a lot of podcasts, and he's a good guest, you know? Trouble that I think that you run up against is that there are all these slots that are prefabricated for political thought. And right now, what's happening is the free speech advocates are actually somehow being positioned into the right. And that if you're critical at all of, say, the way racial politics is slotted in as multiculturalism and you want to challenge some of the ideology there, you're going to be slotted into the right. How do you, and how does Brendan, and how does Spiked try to keep the radical edge and stop this positioning of them, of the publication and of their ideas as conservative from happening? Or how do you combat that?
Well, I think you don't want to get too drawn into just constantly batting back people's kind of quite ignorant preconceptions, but I think the main point is to kind of make your arguments and also to sketch out what the history of what we're talking about is. I mean, the point at which people are trying to present being in favor of free speech as a kind of right wing value clearly haven't read any history. I mean, insofar as the right being, you know, the most fiercest proponents of freedom of speech for a very long time, it is a profound historical absurdity that we live in a situation where the right are left to defending freedom of speech. And it speaks a lot to the degradation, the kind of contortions of the left that we've gotten into this position. And I think it's also important to note that there are many people, especially as bad things have gotten, on the left, who are now piping up about this. People like Peter Tatchell in the UK, a gay rights campaigner, who's always had a pretty good line on freedom of speech. He's got his problems, but don't they all? Who is making a very strong case for it. And also, we can't forget that at the moment, we're seeing this incredible phenomenon whereby the reaction to the kind of campus snowflakes from the right is as victimized, is as victimhood obsessed as the people they claim to be taking aim against. I mean, you not only see this in this kind of belligerent response to any kind of campus crazy, not critiquing their ideas, but just kind of guffawing at them. That to me is not particularly productive. But also you see it in terms of things like Black Lives Matter, a movement I have a lot of problems with, in terms of their outlook, very anti-universalist and have their own issues with victimhood. Yet you have this response from the right, which is saying that they're inciting violence against the police, that they're kind of promoting black nationalism, all of which does them a bit too much credit, I think. But I think the important thing to point out here is not only to demonstrate that there is a left-wing history of fighting for freedom of speech, which is important to look at. Progressives over the years have looked to expand freedom rather than limit it. And at the same time, that the right has never been stalwart defenders of it. And even to this day, in the reaction against the kind of new PC craze on campus, a lot of them reflect a lot of the same easily offended, vulnerable aspects to this. So I think, in terms of claiming free speech as a left-wing value, of telling people, of insisting that we are on the left, I don't see it as a case of trying to convince everyone. I think it's a case of us just burnishing our arguments and making it clear that we're serious about this, and that we can demonstrate that this has a real progressive history that we want to be a part of extending. But, you know, you can't answer everyone's prejudices all day.
Today I'm going to walk you through some really easy steps to freeze your peaches. Now, you can go ahead and use really nice, firm peaches, or you can use this method for any type of fruit you have. But you're going to want to check a really good canning and freezing guide. Today we're going to use a wet pack method for freezing our fruit. So let me walk through the materials that you're going to need. Some sugar, some bags for freezing, some lemon juice, or if you have it, ascorbic acid. Some really nice, firm fruit.
We shall be all right.
Were you at all involved with the Occupy movement?
No, see, I was one of these people who, well, first of all, I became aware of Spiked and started reading and started going to events and stuff at quite a young age. I was about 16, 17. So that inoculated me against a lot of things going into university. But also, I think in general, I was one of the many people who I recognised as people who were political, who were interested in ideas, interested in the world. But you get to university and you kind of shop around the student left looking for what's going on, and you're quite put off by it. For me, I was at a university called Sussex, which is on the south coast near a town called Brighton, very liberal place, kind of the gay capital of the UK. And all that was going on there was just this kind of very downbeat, nostalgic quasi-Marxism. That was kind of the only thing that was really at play. This is really before the explosion of kind of 2013, 2014, when it becomes all about trigger warnings and all that nonsense. They were hanging on to something that resembled something a bit more substantial, but really it was just kind of throwback shadow play. And the one thing, my big experience of censorship there was that there was this huge concern still with no platform for fascists, which is this old National Union of Students policy whereby student unions, as part of the progressive movement, shouldn't share platforms or allow far-right racist speakers to speak on campus. And that's one of the things which I think really put me off, insofar as not only was it censorious, something which I'd come to recognise as a very damaging thing, but also it was just the extent to which a lot of the student left today, I think, are involved in kind of shadow play. They're involved with trying to kind of breed their own folk devils so that they've got something to rail against. This obsession, particularly at Sussex while I was there, with fascism, something which, as I said, Brighton's the gay capital of the UK. If fascism is anywhere in Britain, it's not there. And I think it demonstrated that hand in hand with this new censorious sentiment is this desire to kind of replay the political battles in the past so they don't really have to think about the challenges of the present. And you see this with microaggressions, the looking for racism where it isn't. You see this with campus feminism turning everything into some sort of tentacle of the patriarchy. And I think that's one thing, whereas the current kind of safe space mania, as it were, hadn't really exploded yet. There was still this element which was not only censorious but also kind of retro in a very negative way, and that's something which put me off, as I'm sure it does put a lot of students off today.
Yeah, you know, I think you really hit on something there that is important, and this is why the way that college campuses have become reactive and the way that political correctness is operating online and in our politics in general is so troubling to me. It's because it is a way to avoid engagement with the present moment, with the challenges, the real political and social challenges that we actually have in this moment. It's a way to be diverted into false arguments and sort of ritualistic violence almost at times. And I really liked the essay from Joanna Williams in your book, where she writes about how critical theory and post-structuralism are ideological culprits for today's regressive student movements. And intellectually, post-structuralism is a way to, I think, avoid the responsibility for changing the structures of society by positing this idea that there are no structures, that these structures are ideological, that they're just something we artificially impose on the world, but that we don't actually materially change the world or create structures in it that guide us through life.
No, Joanna's chapter is excellent, and I think it does a great job of sketching out not only the trends which feed into this, but also, as we've already been talking about, the kind of degradation of the left in a really interesting and erudite fashion. Because I think her discussion of critical theory, of, you know, the Frankfurt School, and then through to how it develops, particularly in the UK, of cultural studies, it just demonstrated the point where the point at which the left becomes particularly interested in policing speech and limiting freedom is a point at which they stop believing in political change, right? There's a kind of, and especially believing in ordinary people's ability to change the world. It's a moment of retreat. Even Stuart Hall, who's obviously the great father of cultural studies here in the UK, who set up the Centre for Cultural Studies in Birmingham in the 60s, he made this point. He said that this was a site, or a locus to which, rather, that we retreated. It was a product of the failure of the progressive imagination, the tendency to fall back on a prejudice that ultimately, you know, the masses, the working classes, were just too, you know, incapable by nature of, I mean, effectively their own stupidness, it feels like, to actually get involved and change the world and change the political economy. I think what Joanna does brilliantly in that chapter is not only sketch out how these various intellectual trends feed a censorious climate on campus today, but how that really freedom of speech is, as you can see, a kind of ultimately a progressive value, because it's the moment at which the left retreat from believing in progressive change that they also stop believing in freedom of speech. And I think that's a really core thing that Joanna pulls out there.
I want to return now, and we'll see how I edit this together. I think that this is going well. You give such good answers, it's hard to figure out a way to for a line of attack, you know. But I'll just tell you a little story. My son, Benjamin, is going to be going tomorrow to a libertarian event where they're showing a film, which maybe the people at Spiked would quite enjoy. It's called Can't We Take a Joke? And it's put together by a libertarian, like right libertarian group that are recruiting students through showing this film critiquing political correctness on campus. And he's going to be going to the event, and he bought himself a red shirt, and with his mother's help, he's 19, but he needed his mother's help, he painted a sickle and hammer on his shirt. you know, like flag. And he's going to go there with carrying the Communist Manifesto and wearing a sickle and hammer shirt. And I think he wants to buy a product called Linen Aid, which has a picture of linen on the – it's like a soda pop. And the whole idea is that he will – you know, he'll be trolling this group to see what their reaction is to him, see if they can take a joke. I bring this up only in so much as to say that there are actually limits to the way the right handles free speech. Not that they're going to censor my son. I doubt they will. They probably won't like all this very much if they notice at all. But that the way the right tends to think about freedom in general is that it's the freedom of the propertied class. And that's it. I mean, that's in full stop. It's the freedom of the property class. It's the freedom to get the markets to work properly. It's the freedom that capitalism can provide. And once you start to want to get beyond that kind of freedom to something else, you're on the left. And you're kind of in a tough position because you're going to have to invent a new way to live, a new kind of economy, a new set of principles to back up your freedom. And they don't exist yet, right? That's the position of the left, is wanting to progress to some new society. And so it's very tempting, I think, if you're on the left, to become censorious and to become authoritarian. We've seen it in the 20th century. But despite that temptation or that error on the left, the truth is the left is aiming at a broadening freedoms beyond the bourgeois level. And I wonder if engaging with the regressive left too much, we lose sight of this true left goal.
Yeah, I think that certainly is a problem. And you see this particularly with the right-wing response to the kind of campus crazy, shall we call them, or as they like to call them, insofar as it's very tempting to just spend all of your time venting all of your spleen at these kind of mad people. And there's only so far that can really go. And also you get into the danger of kind of scapegoating them. It's easy to just say that these people are nuts rather than actually try and work out why they think the way they do and what the antecedents to it are. But what I think these students really express is, as I say, quite a mainstream sentiment, which is a lack of belief in autonomy and human agency, which is a left-right problem. No one really believes nowadays that individuals are capable of looking after their own affairs, thinking for themselves, and being a part of some sort of important change. And I think that's something which really needs to be revived and really needs to be demonstrated. I mean, the right aren't going to do it insofar as that they're ultimately uninterested in something new, and also because of their tendency to see freedom in very instrumental ways. You know, it's purely, as you say, to shore up the markets, or it's just the best we can do in terms of, you know, keeping the economy ticking over. There's not a kind of deeper belief in its meaning and what it can do on a moral and intellectual and societal level. But I think it's very important that we need to get to grips with this complete undermining of autonomy, which is basically, if we're going back to Marx, the idea that people can make history. And I think that's something which is in really low regard nowadays. And it gets expressed in two ways. First of all, you have the kind of campus radicals. So you've got someone like the Roads Must Fall movement at Oxford, you know, this campaign to tear down this statue of this long dead colonialist, and this argument that as a black student walking past it is the equivalent of being punched in the face. So they don't believe they can make history. They think they're being beaten up by it. That's a big problem. We need to attack that, and we need to argue with those ideas. And then also you have this failure of imagination and this crisis of autonomy, I think, is a left-right problem. So I think in trying to take up the arguments of students on campus today and trying to demonstrate how illiberal, how damaging they are, I think we also get at an important underpinning problem, which is that belief in the idea of there could be something different, there could be something new, we could expand freedom beyond what it is already, is really not on the table anymore. And I think that this is a core way of kind of getting into that discussion. So I think, yes, we can't spend all our time expending all of our energy on these nut jobs, but at the same time, they express a very profound crisis, which I think would help us get to grips with why there is such a dearth of political imagination at the moment.
Yeah, you know, the idea of knocking over a statue of an imperialist is one which I kind of feel is double-edged. On the one hand, it's censorious and it's ridiculous to think that statue literally is creating an unsafe experience or is going to traumatize you. But on the other hand, I remember, or think about, I don't remember because I wasn't there, but I do think about the Paris Commune and how they attacked the Vendôme and toppled the Vendôme column as a symbol for setting up a new basis for society. And I wonder if the problem with the student radicals when they're knocking down statues or attacking these symbols is that they are always staying there. They have no positive platform afterwards. They're not saying, we're going to get rid of these statues and put up a statue of ourselves, which I would almost respect more, you know, than saying we're going to knock down these statues because they terrify us or they make us sad.
You've hit the nail on the head, because what we have here is not the because again, it's like the discussion around Rose Must Fall. I'm not trying to suggest that it's an act of censorship to remove a statue, or that, you know, every statue that's in existence should be there forever. Otherwise, we're just pandering to, you know, the offence-taking proclivities of students. But I think you've really hit the nail on the head insofar as this is not toppling a statue as an expression of self-determination, of a new politics. It's toppling a statue on the basis of self-esteem, which is, you know, ultimately so tragic that it really that's why I think anyone who's interested in real radicalism and progressivism should have nothing to do with something like Rose Must Fall, because it's the politics of symbolism in the absence of any substance. There's obviously the point at which you have, again, you have some sort of uprising, revolution, and so, you know, you topple the statue in the town square. That's a positive expression of a real substantial political change, a toppling of the old order. This is something entirely different. You know, this is students trawling through history to look for something to be upset about. And if anything, it expresses their lack of ideas and their lack of belief in themselves to do anything. They still feel that the history of colonialism weighs heavy on their back. So I think that you've really hit the nail on the head. This obsession with statues, with policing speech, it taps into really what is the politics of anti-politics and the politics of victimhood. They have nothing to say, so they can only tell you what they're against. And they have nothing to... And they also have this idea that they're actually kind of incapable of having political change. So yes, I think the thing about something like Rose Must Fall is not that statues should be there forever, but it's just the fact that this is the politics of symbolism in the absence of any substance, and that really is a big problem.
We take a crack at the notion of rape culture or the problem of sexual assault on college campuses. One thing that is obvious is that the whole politics around this are precisely the opposite of the politics of the free speech movement or, let's say, the student radicals in Paris in 68. I mean, in Paris in 1968, one of the reasons that blew up and there was a general strike, one of the catalyst for that was demanding the right to go into your girlfriend's dorm room
exactly,
and not to be chaperoned everywhere. They wanted to fuck, basically. And so nowadays it seems like that's the last thing people want, or it's very schizophrenic.
And this is one thing that, as I said, a lot of students really need to grapple with, insofar as they really don't see the connection between this kind of growing sex panic on campus, you know, this rolling out of consent workshops and this talk about rape culture and how pop songs or posters or anything feeds this idea that men are going to defile women and women will be victim to it, really gets to grips with the underlying problem, which is a lack of belief that students are able to fondle for themselves, let alone think for themselves. That's kind of the issue here. And as you say, I mean, one of the things around the both in the both in 1968 as well as 1964 in terms of the free speech movement, the target really was in loco parentis, which not only meant that campus officials could monitor what you say, what you think, what political activities you're able to get involved with. It was also basically about keeping the girls away from the boys, you know, getting the girls to sign in at a certain time, and making sure that they didn't mix, really playing parent in a sense. And I think that's one thing that the way in which the kind of gains of the free speech movement, of believing that students were capable of engaging in ideas and politics, as that's rolled back, you've also seen the rolling back of sexual freedom for students on campus. It's at that point that you see this heightened concern, this nonsense about rape being huge and widespread, and also this idea that women in general are kind of incapable of operating in the public sphere without being either deeply offended or perhaps somehow defiled by it. Those two things go very much hand in hand, and that's one thing which really concerns me about a lot of students who buy the idea that there is a rape culture but are still against the idea of campus censorship. That's a real thing that happens, and you think you don't recognise that these two things are very much interlinked, not only because they both survive off of, you know, the same kind of imperiled mindset, the same kind of fear-mongering, the same kind of lack of belief in students, but also because it's sexual liberation goes hand in hand with free expression, as far as I'm concerned, because it's about saying I'm able of dealing in my own affairs and of putting up with, you know, the kind of risk and the danger that's involved with being a free individual, which sometimes means you'll be offended, which also sometimes means you'll be subject to a slightly impolite come on. But that's really about being an adult and about being a citizen. So I think that really one thing about the campus sexual assault panic is that it's just another expression of this very downbeat, very illiberal sentiment. And I think it's important that we make that connection.
And if you look at the stats, they're very contested, the ones that are trotted out a lot, which is something like 1 in 5 college girls are molested or attacked. That those stats are kind of cooked. Is that right?
Oh, 100%. There's been some great writing on this in the US from people like Christina Hoff Summers and Kathy Young, who've really gone through and debunked this stuff. Because as you say, 1 in 5, which goes back to a campus sexual assault study in 2007, I think, which claims that, again, 1 in 5 women are subject to sexual assault or harassment. You dig into that, not only are the categories so broad, they include things like touching over clothes, along with, you know, forced penetration and rape, but also things like counting any encounter that these female students reported out of a very small self-selecting sample that involved alcohol as some form of alcohol-induced sexual assault. So it's flagrant advocacy research. And one of the fascinating things about it is that as it's become so prominent in the discussion, even the authors of the paper came out and wrote this piece for Time magazine saying that there are caveats which you must remember if you use this 1 in 5 statistic. So contested, even the people who produced it have now come out and contested it. And what we saw in the UK a few years later was that the National Union of Students came out with their own 1 in 7 stat. They were sad that they didn't have their own fear-mongering stats, so they kind of cooked up their own, which again was as ridiculous. You had things in there which indeed just including things like unwanted sexual comments or contact, which I think if that was really the bar for sexual assault, then we'd all be reporting people to the police. So I think really, yes, these stats are absolute nonsense. But it is interesting as to why these have been taken so seriously by the media, by university administration, setting up these kangaroo courts for young men who might have, you know, acted somewhat ungentlemanly once. So, yes, it is. These stats are completely wrong, completely fabricated. They should be taken with a huge pinch of salt. But one thing that always fascinates me is why have they been taken so seriously up until this point?
The thing about this particular issue, it's a nasty issue. No one really wants to spend a lot of time arguing about this. And I think the kind of the gentlemanly thing to do is when someone says anything about this subject, you just say, oh, you're right, it's terrible. That's, you know, just, yes, oh my God, it's awful. Because it is, it's a horrible thing. It's debasing and dehumanizing on a level that is hard to fathom. And the notion of rape is horrific. So it's the worst, you know, and also sexuality is a messy business anyway. And, you know, people are uncomfortable about it, despite the fact that we're a supposedly libertine society. It's a hot button issue, even just, you know, just talking about people's sexual proclivities, let alone throwing in the horror show of rape. So it's an issue which I think is easy to not think about clearly or not put a lot of scrutiny on. And if, when you do, the social consequences are dramatic. I mean, look in the United States, the attacks on George Will, the conservative columnist George Will, were a good example where he said some fairly innocuous things. I think he was critiquing these very stats, and people said he needed to lose his job and that he was a rape apologist. So, I mean, you get called a rape apologist pretty quickly if you try to, and that's a label that stings and can hurt. It can even end careers, I think.
No, definitely. And I think that's one of the real horrible consequences of this politicization of rape. I mean, it's not even rape what they're talking about. It's this huge inflated category. Is that, again, it's something which is really difficult to criticize, because what they're talking about, they present what they're talking about as the thing that we all know is horrible, dehumanizing, and, you know, abhorrent. But they're redefining that as something which includes speech and behavior that we'd all see as part of the cut and thrust of being in the adult world. And I think that's been not only one of the kind of tricks that these people have played, but it's also been a way through which they've been able to kind of slip through what is really just kind of prejudicial treatment of certain people that they don't like, right? This has become a sort of battering ram of the issue, which we should all be concerned about. But by overinflating it, they've also been able to make an argument for just kind of clamping down on the sorts of elements on university campuses which particularly kind of middle-class feminists have always had a bit of a problem with. So in the US, of course, that's the kind of frat boys, the crass, you know, sports panty-raiding kind of characters who have always struck the sort of people who hang around gender studies seminars as douchebags. They've used this purely as a kind of pretext in which to really demonise them in a very, very ugly way. And in the UK, we have this equivalent, which is lad culture, which is a kind of more amorphous phenomenon. It's just a sort of, it's kind of cropped up in the 90s as just a way of this kind of hyper-affected working class sentiment where you refer to birds and drink lager and all the rest of it, just kind of silly adolescent phase, has been presented by the National Union of Students as effectively the cause of all sexual harassment on campus. And I think that really taps into, again, a very kind of snobby sort of sentiment. So I think that's one of the worst consequences of all of this, is that that something which should be a very, very serious issue has been trivialized, and it's been trivialized to serve quite a snobby agenda. And I think that's really, really quite ugly.
I don't know a solution to this except to do the kind of work you're doing, but it seems like you're pushing against a wall here.
But I think in terms of taking the kind of campus culture up on all of these things, and that goes not just for the sexual assault panic, but also just, you know, the mainstreaming of censorship across university campuses, this very anti-progressive, anti-radical desire to protect everyone from offence. I think there are reasons to be hopeful, and not only because there's certain groups who are doing great work, but there's so many students who we come into contact with who are fed up with this stuff. And I think that's been one of the real responses to the fact that this has gotten so mad, that the censorship has gotten so out of control, that it's come down to not censoring fascists but censoring feminists, not to censoring, you know, far right characters, censoring hats. I think that has produced a very visceral kickback amongst students who otherwise would have been quite happy to let the, you know, nutcases get on with it. I think that's been very positive. And I think what we've got at the moment is a bit of an opening whereby we can really make the case for free speech as an absolute on campus. And the point that if you have any censorship on campus, you can entirely undermine the point of it, not only because you can't really pursue truth if you put certain ideas off the table, but also because you undermine the idea that students as young people who are interested in the world might change things. So I think what we have at the moment is a real opening to make that case. And even though it's not perfect, even though it's not fully formed, I think what's starting to happen on campus is a reason to be cheerful, because it's the start of something which could revive a belief in free speech, a belief in autonomy, and ultimately a belief in progressive change. So I think there are reasons to be optimistic.